that introduction, and he's so embarrassed he's actually left. But with an introduction like that, I can only be a disappointment to you. But what won't be a disappointment, I certainly hope, will be the fact that we're going to be opening the Bible to the opening pages of Genesis. And there we're going to be looking at some of the most fascinating and yet most controversial pages that there are in the Bible. And over the years, because people know that I've had kind of an interest in the book of Genesis, I've been asked to speak on Genesis more times than I care to remember now. And I often find that some people are very disappointed with what I have to say, in that I didn't confirm any of their prejudices. And you know, the first words that God speaks in the creation account in Genesis 1, it says, "And God said, let there be light." Unfortunately, in our discussion of Genesis, often you'd think the first words were, "Let there be heat," because the discussion on Genesis has often generated more heat than light. But I know that you're all enlightened and open to discussion. So I'm sure that I might say something this evening with which you disagree, and in fact you may say something with which I disagree. You'll know that because I'll say, "Well, thank you for that very interesting question." We're mature Christians, so we're coming to God's Word, and our desire is to understand it better so that we can apply it in a deeper and in more enriching way to our lives. And that's one of the fascinating things for me in studying the Bible, is that I'm constantly learning. I'm constantly seeing new things and saying to myself, you know, I've looked at that 100 times. Why did I never see it before? And some of the things that I see because it's what people like you point out. So I hope I'm going to learn something from you this evening. With this weekend, we're looking at Genesis 1 to 11. The book of Genesis has got 4 main sections to it. Genesis 1 to 11, which we're going to be looking at this weekend, is known as the primeval history. The primeval history, that is the history of the first age of the earth. And then that's followed by 3 other sections: the story of Abraham, the story of Jacob, and then the story of Joseph, or the story of Jacob's family, as it should perhaps better be known. So we're not going to be looking at the whole of Genesis, but we're looking at the first 11 chapters, which take us from creation in chapter 1 through to the Tower of Babel in chapter 11. It's a self-contained unit which is concerned with the first age of the earth. Now, quite often, as you know, when people discuss these opening chapters of Genesis, the questions that are raised are usually scientific questions, or perhaps historical questions. You go into a like an Adventist book shop, and you look at volumes on Genesis, and 99% of them are on matters of science, creation, evolution, and so on. But we very few on what I hope we'll see this evening, which is the title I've given: the spiritual value of the book of Genesis in particular, and of Genesis 1. That is to say, the primary purpose, in my opinion, the primary purpose of the book of Genesis is to provide spiritual nurture for God's people. And I hope that we can see the spiritual value of Genesis 1, while we might raise some other questions about the historical or scientific value, yes. But unless we understand the spiritual value, we've missed the main target, it seems to me, as to what God's Word is all about. So in order to do that, we obviously have to be selective. And there will be some details in Genesis that I will skip over. Now, you know, I'm an honest fellow, all right? I'm not skipping over them because they're too difficult to deal with. It's just, if we dealt with everything, we'd be here for weeks. So feel free to raise some details I might skip over in, you know, questions, and I'll try to answer them as well as I'm able. Now, One of the main questions I'd like us to explore this evening is what Genesis would have meant to its original readers, to its original hearers. Because the book of Genesis was not written in Crieff yesterday. Okay? It was written a long time ago, thousands of years ago. It was written in a different culture, ancient Israelite culture. It was written in a different language, the language of Hebrew. And so we cannot simply just ignore the gap of history, culture, and language. And in fact, what I would say is that if we can try to close that gap through some study of the text of history, culture, and language, we'll be able to, I think, get to the heart of what Genesis 1 is talking about. So, to begin with, I want us to step back a little bit from Genesis 1 to take in a broad view. So, just before we do that, I just need to say something about the nature of Old Testament and Hebrew narratives, Old Testament literature. Hebrew literature, remember Genesis was originally written in Hebrew. Hebrew literature delights in using patterns of balance and repetition and structured narratives. It delights in doing that in a way that we, in modern European literature, we don't do that in the same way. So to begin with, I just want to ask this simple question about Genesis 1, to look at the structure of Genesis 1. We're not going to spend a long time on this. But when we look at the structure of Genesis 1 and ask this simple question, that as we move through the days of creation of Genesis 1, what new elements do we meet on each day of creation that we have not met before? And so when we ask that question, we get this kind of structure or this grid, which I'm going to show now. Now, some of you may have seen something similar to this before, but I just want to deal with it briefly now. So when you ask that question, that is how the opening chapter of Genesis pans out. Now, let me just explain a little bit to begin with. Now, at the beginning, remember, it says, now, the earth was, what does Genesis say at the beginning? The earth was without form and void. Now, that is the traditional English translation of two Hebrew words. What the text says in the original language is that the earth was tohu wabohu. And I think it's best just to leave that untranslated, because I think that gives you a pretty good impression of what the earth was like. It was all tohu wabohu. That is the Hebrew way of saying without form and void. In other words, it was chaotic. It didn't have the form, it didn't have the structure, it's not yet what God wants it to be. Okay? So that's what we start with, a chaotic state, disordered, and God in creation is going to set out to create and order it to be what he wants it to be. And then we go through days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And one of the things about reading Genesis is that we often read in this linear fashion, you know, day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, and so on. But you'll notice that when you look at the main elements that are created on each day, for example, on day 1, God says, let there be light. And once we have light, we can have a distinction between light and darkness. God calls the light day, and the darkness he calls night. And so that's what's new on the first day. And so we don't have time to look in detail as to how this, you know, pans out, reading everything. But I'm a lecturer, you know, I mean, trust me. All right. That's what you get on each of the days. So on the first day, you get day and night. Day 2, sea and sky. Day 3, you get dry land and vegetation. Day 4, you have the sun, moon and stars bundled together. You have on day 5, fish and birds, and on day 6, land animals and humans. And so you get that progression. But if we have tunnel vision, we just have tunnel vision, we work our way through the week, what we fail to see is what I just mentioned about Hebrew literature emphasizing structure and repetition and balance. Because if you look at it, you can see that day one balances day four, right? In other words, when do you see the sun? In the day. Now, I know in Scotland you don't always see the sun in the day, but you know, the sun, remember what it says in the text, the sun is to rule the day, and the moon is to rule the night, okay? Day two, you have the sea and sky. Now, the fish live in the sea, the birds fly in the sky. On day six, you have land animals and humans, and land animals, this is a difficult concept, but land animals live on the land, all right? And both land animals and humans both live on the dry land, and both are sustained by vegetation. So we get these balancing pairs of days. You follow the point? It's a simple, kind of structure. So horizontally, the creation account is built so that those days match one another. But even more important than the horizontal correspondence is the vertical correspondence, because we began with tohu wa bohu, tohu wa bohu, chaos, and we end with rest. We end with Sabbath. So if you look at the structure of the creation week, then the goal, the aim, the climax of creation is the Sabbath. Now that's not the first, that's not the last time I'm going to mention it this evening. And the reason why it's not the last time I'm going to mention it is that I've spoken on Genesis to various groups, to you know, Anglicans, Baptists, mixed agnostics and atheists. There's only one group of people I've ever spoken to who wish to argue that the Sabbath is not the climax of creation, and those people are Adventists. Everybody else can see it, but for some reason, and you may be among them, for some reason, some Adventists feel that that cannot be the case. Okay, but we'll return to that, because I'm sure some of you want to raise that question. So, just looking at the structure of this first week of creation, then, what are the implications that arise from this? Remember, the question we're asking is the spiritual value, the theological value of Genesis 1. Well, the first thing we can say, which I've already alluded to, is that God is a God of order. Creation proceeds in an orderly fashion. There's a balance and connection between the various parts. There's a coherence in what God does. Second point is that God brings order out of chaos. So we begin with chaos, we end with Sabbath, and we get to Sabbath through an organized, balanced structure. So God brings order out of chaos. Now this is, I would say, perhaps the single most important point to take from Genesis chapter 1, that God brings order out of chaos, because that is a point which is repeated through several of the passages in Genesis 1 to 11. And what's interesting about this is that it works at two levels. So when we say here that God brings order out of chaos in Genesis chapter 1, we're talking about physical chaos, right? Physical chaos. What was it? What was without form and void? What was without form and void was the earth. So it's physical chaos leading to physical order. But as you read your way through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, you discover that the book is also interested in another kind of chaos, and another kind of order. And this kind of chaos and order is not physical chaos, but it's moral and spiritual chaos and moral and spiritual order. And that's one of the points that Genesis will underline. We'll come back to this more than once during the next 24 hours or so. All we've seen at the moment is that God brings physical order out of physical chaos. But keep your eye on that, because we'll see how God sets out to bring moral and spiritual order out of moral and spiritual chaos. Then a third point would be that humans are not the climax of creation. We are, as human beings, we're created in the image of God. In all of creation, it's only human beings who are created in the image of God. Human beings are important. And in fact, that is, the fact that we are important is an important point, which we'll deal with this evening. However, what's just as important to see is that human beings are not the climax of creation. The climax of creation is the Sabbath. And what does that mean? It means that holy time is the climax of creation. So as human beings, we might be presented as being the climax of God's physical creation. You know, what you can touch and feel and see. But creation is about more than just physical things. It's also about spiritual and moral things. And the climax of creation is holy time. Now, you can't go down to the local supermarket and ask for, you know, 8 ounces of holy time, please. You know, do you have it on special offer this week? Holy time is spiritual. You can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can only experience it. And it is that which climaxes God's creation. Okay, so those are some broad points to make from just the simple way in which Genesis 1 is put together. We'll come back to some of these basic building blocks later. Now, there's another aspect of Genesis 1 that I want us to look at, which I think opens our eyes to what Genesis is really interested in. And that is to ask, what would its original readers, what would its original hearers have made of this text? Now, Genesis 1 was written, as we said, thousands of years ago in Hebrew, in a different culture. It was written in the ancient Near East. And at many places in the account of Genesis 1, you can see how this account is aware of what the people of its time believed. Now, that shouldn't surprise us, should it? That when the Bible is written, it's aware of what people at the time believed. So Genesis, as I hope we'll see, is in dialogue with the beliefs of its time. And it takes the opportunity to be radical and to suggest things about the nature of God, the nature of the world, and what it means to be human. It takes the opportunity to present a radical manifesto which flies in the face of the received wisdom in the world at the time when it was written. So let's have a look at that. Now, I should perhaps say this as a general point as well. In the ancient Near East, that is the world in which Genesis existed, there were plenty of creation stories. The Egyptians had them, the Babylonians, Assyrians, and so on. Plenty of creation stories. But these people treated creation rather differently than we do. That is to say, for those people, creation was never a self-contained topic. People didn't say, let's sit down and discuss creation. Or let's sit down and perhaps argue about creation. No, the creation stories in the ancient world were a way in which people explored matters of ultimate significance. So their creation stories are ways of approaching life's most important questions. Who am I? Why am I here? Is there meaning to life? So creation stories are ways in which you approach the most important questions in life, and I believe that is actually what Genesis sets out to do. Now, please don't misunderstand me when I say this, but the primary reason that Genesis 1 was written was not to prove that Charles Darwin is wrong. You understand what I mean? That's not the primary reason. It is to address matters of ultimate significance. The world in which Genesis arose in the ancient Near East, were these stories of creation were less interested in how, they were less interested in what, they were much more interested in so what. So what? During my career as a lecturer, I became known to some students as Lawrence So What Turner, because that was sometimes the comment I would put at the bottom of an essay, earnestly written. And I would ask, so what? You've got all the footnotes and you've got all the arguments, but what is the point? What's the big picture? And Genesis is really concerned with that big picture. Now, let's get into the text then. That's got a background. We get into the text and we look. I know that you've all got Bibles, and I've decided to put some of these texts on the screen, not because I know you can't find your way to Genesis chapter 1, but sometimes it helps, you know, because I can point out something. So we all know the opening verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I say we all know that, and sometimes there's a danger in the familiar. Because it's so familiar, I think we sometimes forget just how radical this statement is. That in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Because this opening statement of the Bible takes us to the limits of time and the limits of space. In the beginning. Well, that takes you to the limits of time. You can't get back beyond the beginning, right? Because if you did, well, it wouldn't be the beginning. All right? So, in the beginning takes us to the limits of time. God created the heavens and the earth. Heavens and the earth, this is a Hebrew idiom. The heavens, the highest point above, the earth, the lowest point below. Which means the highest point above, the lowest point below, and everything in between. The totality of space. So just an idiom for that. So it takes us to the limits of time in the beginning, the limits of space, the heavens and the earth, and everything that there is. In other words, it's saying that God is the Lord of time and space. And that's a profound thought expressed in this simple language, that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And immediately, we read that. Any ancient Near Eastern people hearing this text would immediately start to bridle a bit at that. You know, they begin to say, right, what was that you say? Because the opening verse of Genesis suggests the eternity of God. Because in the beginning, God creates everything. So it suggests the eternity of God. Now, you might well think, look, I haven't come out on a cold and dreary evening. You know, hear you tell me that God is eternal, because I learned that in primary school Sabbath, in the primary Sabbath school class. But the interesting thing is, of course, that is old hat to us. But to people living in the ancient world, for many of them, most of them, the gods were not eternal. The gods were created. And these creation mythologies that you read in Egypt and Assyria and Babylon give us stories not only about the creation and origin of the earth and the universe, but on the origins of the gods themselves. How did the gods come into existence? So I could give you many examples, but if we look at this next one, this is from the Babylonian creation epic, known as Enuma Elish after its opening lines. This is how it opens up. When skies above were not yet named, nor earth below pronounced by name, Apsu, the first one, their begetter, and maker Tiamat, who bore them all. Tiamat is a fearsome monster of the deep. You wouldn't want to meet her on a dark night. We'll meet her later on. Who bore them all. These two had mixed their waters together, but had not formed pastures nor discovered reed beds. You see, we're building up to something here. Then what do we read? When yet no gods were manifest, nor names pronounced, nor destinies decreed, then gods were born within them. So these gods are not eternal. So it might be old hat to you, but it's not to people who read the Babylonian creation epic. Look at Egyptian texts, a couple of quick Egyptian texts here. Praise to you, Atum, praise to you, Khepra, who created himself. You became high in this your name, high ground. You created yourself in this your name, Khepra. So this is how this Egyptian god came into existence. Another Egyptian text. See, I am prosperous. I created my body in my glory. I am he who made myself. I formed myself according to my will and according to my heart. Now, that is rather different than Genesis, isn't it? Not just different from Genesis, but different from anything we have in the Bible. Because the Bible nowhere speculates about the origin of God. Because you can't really speculate about the origin of a being who is eternal. So, Genesis' statement on, as it were, the eternity of God is something which doesn't quite gel with the general view of the time. Something else about this opening verse: in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, now this verse obviously makes a distinction between the creator and creation, right? In the beginning, to paraphrase it, in the beginning, the Creator created creation. I hadn't thought of that before coming just then, but you know, you follow what I mean. In the beginning, the Creator created creation. The Creator and creation are separate entities. Well, once again, that would be a novel notion to most people in the ancient world, because the distinction between the gods and creation for many people was not made. So if you you look out and you look at the tree, the distinction between a tree and the god of the tree, well, they're all, you know, somehow mixed together. The whole of creation had divinity running through it, a bit like a thinly spread Marmite, as it were, across throughout raspberry ripple ice cream, if that's a better analogy. So pantheism, the idea that divinity resides within everything there is, that was the normal way of looking at things. So for Genesis to say that the creator and creation, the creator stands outside of creation and is Lord over creation, That's a novel idea. And so by the time we get to the end of the first verse, which, as you'd admit, is not very far, we've only got to the end of the first verse, and yes, it is 20 to 8. No, 20, yes, it is 20 to 8. And we've only got, but, yeah, I won't be spending equal time on everything, don't worry. But even by the time we get to the end of that first verse, something is beginning to dawn on us, which is that Genesis 1 is an attack, it's an argument against the received wisdom of its time. And the reason why I want to stress that is that these days it's quite common for people to say, you know, all Genesis did, it just reflected the thought of its time. It didn't. It has a radical agenda which flies in the face of the received wisdom of its time, and we've only just started. Now, verse 3. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Now, the rabbis, some schools of rabbis, had a traditional question that they would ask their students. So all their eager beaver little rabbinic students sitting there, listening to the words of wisdom from the master, getting the idea here. The rabbinic teacher would read this verse. Then God said, "Let there be light." And the question the rabbi would ask of the students is, to whom was God speaking, do you think? To whom was he speaking? Because if he's just speaking to himself, you know what we say about people speaking to themselves. Okay. So, to whom was God speaking? And of course, all the eager little rabbinic students would come up with all kinds of ideas, but this was just a teaching technique to underline something that the text is clearly pointing to, which is, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Now, I don't want to be facetious here, but it doesn't say, God said, "Let there be light, and behold, it remained dark." Right? In other words, God only has to command, he only has to wish, and it is. Creation is effortless. That's really the nub of this verse. God creates effortlessly. And if there is one thing about the first chapter of Genesis which flies in the face of the received wisdom of its time, it is this notion that creation is done effortlessly. Let me just emphasize that this is what Genesis 1 does itself emphasize. Let's just look at three examples just to show you. Well, the one we've just seen, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. Verse 11, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass." And it was so. Now, if you've recently read Genesis 1 to 11, and some of you told me that you have, you know that you get an awful lot of that in the first chapter. It gets quite repetitive, doesn't it? God said, and it was so. God said, and it was so. God creates effortlessly. What's the point of that? Because the belief in most of the ancient Near East was that creation did not take place effortlessly, that creation was the result of struggle, in fact, of warfare between the gods. If we come back to the Babylonian creation epic, we read from it a little earlier. Here you've got Marduk. Marduk is the high god of Babylon. So he's the god whose temple it takes pride of place in the city of Babylon. And Tiamat is, we've already mentioned Tiamat, She is this fearsome female monster of the deep, ferocious. And Marduk and Tiamat have been battling it out for a long time. You get this long drawn out account of blow after blow. Now, remember, this is a creation account, okay? Marduk shot an arrow which pierced Tiamat's belly. He split her down the middle and slit her heart, vanquished her and extinguished her life. He threw down her corpse and stood on top of her. And then he slit her in half. With one half of her body, he creates the heavens, and the other half of her body, he creates the earth. But it's creation as the result of struggle, of battle. But Genesis says, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. That's one of the consequences of monotheism. You can't have a battle between the gods if there's only one God. It has to be effortless. So by now, I think you can see the typical ancient Near Eastern person reading Genesis is beginning to scratch their head and feeling thoroughly confused, because Genesis is challenging some of the greatest assumptions of the great thinkers of the time. Now let's go to the fourth day. I know I'm missing things out, as I mentioned before. It's not because they're too difficult, you know, it's just that there's certain things I want to deal with. Now, when you come to the account of the fourth day, and this is found in Genesis 1, verses 14 to 19. Actually, it might be worthwhile reading that. So it's Genesis 1, verses 14 to... Maybe, could somebody read that? It's Genesis 1, 14 to 19.
Said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, a greater light to govern the day and a lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, to separate light from darkness. And God saw it was good, and it was evening, and there was morning before the day.
Thank you. Now, that account of the fourth day we've just read, if you were reading it in Hebrew, that's the language, of course, in which it was originally written, then the account of the fourth day is the longest account so far. It might not look that way in English translation, but in Hebrew that's the case. And one of the reasons, or the main reason, why the account of the fourth day is longer than any of the first 3 days is that on the fourth day, Genesis wants to underline something. And it does that by repeatedly reminding us of something. And that is the functions of these lights, the heavenly lights that are made on the fourth day. So let's just see how that is achieved. So you got Genesis 1, 14, well, 14 to 18, 14 to 19. And what I've highlighted here is how it sets out the functions of these heavenly bodies. And God said, let there be lights. Okay, so that's what they're going to be. They're going to be lights. Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, to separate the light from the darkness. And if you haven't by that time got the point, then you're not listening, okay, as to what these lights are there for. You know, some of this seems so repetitious as to be comical in a way. Let there be lights, okay? All right, let there be lights. And let them be lights, okay? And what are the lights going to do? They're going to give light. Well, okay, of course they are. And they're there to rule and to separate, but they're lights. And so Genesis is saying here, you look up at the heavens, what do you see? You see lights. And ancient people said, oh no, you don't. Oh no, you don't. When you look up at the sky at night, you don't just see lights. You see the gods, because the lights, the stars in particular, the sun and moon, were gods. And these gods ruled human destinies. This is the origin of astrology, the signs of the zodiac and so on. These lights in the sky possess power over your life. And Genesis says, actually, they're just lights. That's all they are. Let me give you an example from, I think this one is, this, well, Mesopotamian astrology. This is there are many of these texts, but a Mesopotamian astrological text. An eclipse of the evening watch. So you get an eclipse which takes place in the evening. An eclipse of the evening watch means plague. An eclipse of the middle watch means diminishing market. An eclipse of the morning watch means the sick will recover. So if you're going to have an eclipse, you want it in the morning. Okay? Good. Positive result. When sin, that's the name of the moon, not what we think of as sin. When the moon makes an eclipse, you must also consider the month, the day, the watch, the wind, the path, and the positions of the stars as they stood during the eclipse, and then you can give the decision in accordance with its month, its day, its watch, its wind, its path, and its star. You study the stars in order to discover human destiny, what is going to happen in the kingdom, in your personal life, professional astrologers reading the stars, because they are not simply lights, they are gods. And Genesis says, no, they're not gods. They're just lights. This is a radical slap in the face for people of the time. So Genesis is rejecting any form of sun worship, any form of moon worship, any form of star worship, any form of astrology which gives to the heavenly bodies power over our lives. And it's also a slap in the face against fatalism. You know, why am I a bad-tempered old so-and-so? You know, I'm always late in everything I do. I just don't like people. Well, it's because I was born under the... you can't do anything about it. Sorry. It was in the stars. Well, it can't be in the stars, says Genesis, because they're just lights. So forget all that fatalism. Now there's something else on this matter too. You remember that grid we looked at about what is created on the first 3 days and the days 4 to 6. There's something about the account of Genesis 1 which I think strikes everybody even the first time they read it. Which is, how can you have light on the first day when you don't get the sun until the fourth day? So just to underline that, this is a modification of that grid which I showed you earlier. On the first day you get light, and on the fourth day you get lights. Now some people say, you know, the author made a mistake there. You can see, you know, he got out of bed the wrong side. That morning he wrote that. Well, Genesis is well aware of this. Not only well aware of it, but exploits it. It underlines it, in fact, because if you read the text, you discover that the word light is used 5 times on day 1, and the lights are used 5 times on day 4. This text knows what it's doing. And what it's doing is saying, don't waste your time worshipping the lights. Worship the one who is himself the source of light. God does not require the sun or the moon for light. They're simply objects which he uses for his purposes. But God is the source of light. So what looks like an oddity simply underlines the main point that Genesis is trying to say, is that God transcends all of creation. He's not in it as such, but he's the creator of it. And then one more point on this matter of what we see on the fourth day. We've been saying that God created the sun. We've got the sun and the moon and the stars. All right. But of course, the text doesn't actually say that. Well, I mean, what I mean, it doesn't use that actual language. It doesn't actually say he made the sun, does it? He made the greater light, and we say, well, obviously that's the sun. And he made the lesser light, well, that's obviously the moon. But why not just say it then? Why not just say he made the sun and he made the moon? Well, probably, because the text doesn't actually tell us why, but probably the reason is this, is that at the time when Genesis was written, the word for sun was also the name of the sun god. And the word for moon was also the name of the moon goddess. And so by using this roundabout way, probably Genesis is wanting to distance itself from any suggestion that it's talking about gods. So they're just relegated to being greater light and lesser light. The other thing also on this is when he says the stars, well, this translation has he made the stars also. It's actually, what the text actually says is simply, and the stars. In the ancient Near East, it was actually the stars that were the most important divine bodies in the sky, followed by the sun and the moon. And it's almost a kind of a contemptuous dismissal of the most important things. He made the greater light and the lesser light and the stars. Those objects which are of greatest importance for deciding human destiny are dismissed, as it were, with a wave of the hand. So, by this time, by this stage, I hope that one thing we can see about Genesis 1 is that it is far more than simply a chronicle of what God did. It's actually a polemic, you know, an argument against the beliefs of its time. It isn't simply giving information for intellectuals who like to know about this sort of thing. It's presenting a completely different concept of the universe, of God, and of humanity. It's a radical statement. Then we come to the sixth day. Okay. Now there's one element in the sixth day, which is always pique people's interest. Why have I got that there? I'll tell you what, I'll miss that. I'll There are many things I have to say, but you cannot bear them now. Okay, so this one. Genesis 1:26. When God sets about to create human beings, he does so with a strange turn of phrase. Let us make humankind in our image, and so on and so forth. Let us. Well, you know, there's been enough ink spilled on this question as to why you have the plural. You could float a battleship in the ink that's been spent on this. Maybe I should ask you, I mean, let us. What explanations have you heard as to why we have the plural here? Let us. Have you heard any explanations of that? Well, one is the Trinity, yes. Anything else?
Something mysterious came to my mind. Gollum.
The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Maybe we'll keep that for another time.
Sorry.
Any other? So that's basically what we've heard is the Trinity.
Playing the devil's advocate, this is obviously another God which is in existence at the time.
Okay, so we got polytheism. Yeah. That's been suggested as well.
First John talks about Christ being involved in creation. Right.
Yes. So we've got Trinity, we've got polytheism, we've got one suggestion is God is talking to the angels. Now, personally, I'm not convinced by those suggestions. That doesn't mean that I don't believe in the Trinity. All right? If those of you are taking notes, please write that down. Okay? It isn't that I don't believe in the Trinity, it's just that I don't think this verse is referring to that. I think the polytheism one, which is mentioned, of course, I just don't think it fits for the simple reason that the account is attacking the polytheism of its time. And this would be an odd thing to do then, to sort of drop the guard at this point. God talking to the angels, where the angels themselves are created beings. So can they create? I think not. Now, I was building up to a point, which, now what was it?
Is he saying that he is totality, he is complete, so us, all the gods of the culture would have believed in those days, everything is in him. He is
Yes, I haven't heard of that before. I'll have to add it. I'll have to think about that and add it to the list. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. Yes, but whatever solution we come up to, whatever solution we come up with, I think that has to answer this question: why is it that in the creation account, the plural "let us" is used only in verse 26 and nowhere else? Why here and nowhere else? Was the Trinity not in existence everywhere else? Is it just in this one verse that the Trinity walked through the door, as it were? If it's the angels, did they only turn up on the sixth day? They were off doing something else, but on the sixth day they turn up. So we have to find a reason why we've got the plural on the sixth day with the creation of human beings and nowhere else in the creation account. Why isn't it plural everywhere? Now, you know, I'm not entirely sure. This is one of the best ways over the years I've found of fending off criticism. I'm not entirely sure of what the answer is. But what I think it is the use of a Hebrew idiom which is known as the plural of deliberation. That's a fancy title, the plural of deliberation. What it basically means is this, that in the Hebrew language, when you want to underline how significant something is, how important it is. So if we're writing the old-fashioned way and you've got, you know, a pen in your hand or whatever, you'd underline it, asterisk in the margin, NB, highlight it, this is important. There are occasions, it seems, where what the Hebrew does is to switch from the singular to the plural, to underline how important this act or statement is. I think that's why it's used here. Because in verse 26, God is making humanity in the image of God, the only part of his creation created in the image of God. And that's why it shifts to the plural in order to underline how important, how significant his action is. We've got another example of this in Genesis 11, at the Tower of Babel, where it says, "Come, let us go down." And who goes down? Well, the Lord goes down. "Let us go down and confuse their language." Now, this is a highly significant event. The Tower of Babel, it's the scattering of humanity through all its cultural and linguistic variations around the world. This is exceptionally important. So it shifts to the plural. Now, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to sail the seven seas or suggest at the next general conference session this become the 29th fundamental belief. You know, I'm not wedded to it like that. But I think that is the reason why we have that. Now, having said that, underlining how important humanity is another way in which Genesis parts company with the thinking of its time. Now, again, if I were to ask you, what is the image of God? Well, you know, you talk to systematic theologians and they say, well, how many months do you have, you know, before I tell you what the image of God is all about? So let me give you a potted version. In the ancient world, kings, emperors, would establish throughout their territories images of themselves. And this was to indicate their authority throughout their entire kingdom. And this account says, you know, human beings have that capacity. We are the image of God, placed in his creation to represent God in this world. If people in this world are going to get to know God, most of the time it's going to be through people like you and me. And without digressing too far, I think that's the significance of the commandment, you shall not make for yourself an image. Why in the world should we not make images if we feel like it? The simple answer is that God already has an image. Us. It's through us that God is made known in the world. So all of that, I think, is underlining that human beings are very important to God, very important within his creation. And why does that matter? Because at the time, most people didn't believe it. Let me give you representative statements by a couple of scholars here. Human beings possessed little dignity and worth and were thought to be merely slaves of the gods. That's what human beings were, slaves to the gods. Another one here. In the ancient worldview, people were slaves to the gods with no dignity other than that which came from the knowledge that the gods could not get along without humans to meet their needs. Another example, the Atrahasis epic, which is a story about the flood, it's similar to the biblical flood story, tells the story of how the gods can't get to sleep at night. And why can't the gods get to sleep at night? Because all those humans are making such a racket, they can't get to sleep. So what do the gods do? Send a flood to get rid of them. Oh, just expendable on the basis. You know, it's a bit like having noisy neighbours and you're going to go around there with a submachine gun, all right? Just expendable. So the idea that humanity has worth, has meaning, has significance, we know that because we know the biblical text. But it wasn't something that most people at the time would have agreed with. But in Genesis, then, human beings rule God's world. Now, we've arrived at the seventh day. So, let's look at the way in which this account of the seventh day begins. You know what it's like? Sometimes some verses in the Bible are so familiar that when we read them, we're no longer reading them. We're sort of smelling the fragrance of them, you know, without actually reading it because they're so familiar to us. And this one is very familiar to us, I'm sure. There's something which has intrigued particularly translators of this seventh day of creation is that if you look at it literally, it seems to contradict itself. Did you ever notice that? See how it starts? Thus, the heavens and the earth were finished. Now, this is the beginning of the account of the seventh day. So when it says, thus, the heavens and the earth were finished, when were they finished then? In the sequence of the days? Yeah, they were finished on the sixth day. So the seventh day account begins, thus, the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work. Well, hang on a minute. I thought it was already finished. I'm reminded of students handing in work to me right at the deadline, you know. And we don't do it this way now, it's all done electronically, but in the good old days when you could stay in your office and receive the physical, you know, object in your hand. Many times a student would knock on the door breathlessly, you know, it's like 30 seconds before the deadline. And they say, here's the essay, it's finished. Well, I've just got to do, you know, I've just got to do, write the introduction and the footnotes and the bibliography and touch up the conclusion, but it's finished. I said, now look, just a minute. Is it finished or is it not finished? Is it complete or is it not complete? And that's the kind of question that you get here. The heavens and the earth were finished. And on the seventh day, God finished the work. But if he's already finished it on the sixth day, what is there to finish on the seventh day? So translators have been perplexed by this, and they've come up with different solutions, which I'll just go through a couple of very quickly. The New English Bible, following the Septuagint, says, on the sixth day, God completed all the work he'd been doing, and on the seventh day, he ceased from his work. Yeah, it's a neat solution. You see what they're doing. He completed it and then he ceases it. But that's not what the text says. Unfortunately, I mean, it's too bad that the text doesn't say that. You found that sometimes in Sabbath school discussions, haven't you? You know, it's too bad the text doesn't actually say it, but I believe it all the same, all right? Now, by the or the New International Version, if I ask any of my students, they'll tell you that I have a particular view on the New International Version. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Yeah, well, again, that's not... There's a fudge here. Now, what it says is, Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and on the seventh day God finished the work. Now, that peculiar way of writing it is, I think, to underline something, I think, very important. What is finished, according to this text? What is finished? Yeah, the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth are finished. The heavens and the earth are, as you said, the physical creation. What you can see, what you can touch, the land, the vegetation, the human beings, the physical creation, that's the heavens and the earth. But on the seventh day, God finishes his work by creating what? The Sabbath. And the Sabbath is holy time. And holy time is not part of the physical creation. You can't pick it up, you can't weigh it, you can't take it to the lab to analyze it. You can experience it. And so this is the way, I believe, another way in which Genesis is underlining that the Sabbath, holy time, is the climax of creation. That is to say, if you conceive of creation without the spiritual, you have missed what creation is ultimately about. So the heavens and the earth are certainly finished by the end of day six, but God's work is not yet finished until he blesses and sanctifies the seventh day, making it holy, making the Sabbath the climax of creation. Yeah. So, all right, I've got to cut this short in righteousness. Okay, let me just come then to a brief summary then at the end. Okay. What does Genesis 1 tell us about God? Well, it tells us many, many things about God. But if we put down maybe the main points we've looked at this evening, God brings order out of chaos. He's the Lord of time and space. He's a personal and eternal God. He is distinct from creation, stands outside it and creates it. And there's only one God, and so he creates effortlessly. There's only one God, so the heavenly bodies are just lights. They do not rule our destiny. What does Genesis 1 say about us? Well, it tells us that we're not the climax of creation. Sometimes it's good to remember that. Important, but not that important. But we have a high status in God's eyes, so it's important not to miss that. In contrast to what other people thought. So we're not the climax of creation, but we have a high status in God's eyes. We're God's representatives on earth, and we're not victims of fate, but we have a relationship with a personal God. And so a couple of final implications which relate to the Sabbath. The Sabbath, I believe this is what Genesis is saying, holy time is the climax of creation. And holy time, as the climax of creation, shows that creation is ultimately a divine and holy enterprise. It isn't simply a gathering together, an organization of atoms and molecules, but it transcends that. So, Genesis 1 challenges ancient assumptions about the nature of God, about the nature of the world, and about the nature of humanity. And I think it would be a pity if we simply use Genesis 1 to score points in arguments which never actually deal with those matters. Genesis was radical then, and it's radical now. So, do we have any time for questions? You notice I said time for questions, not necessarily time for answers. No. Yes.
It's a very little minor point, but you were talking about God said, let us make man.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a thing in the English language called the royal we.
Yeah, the royal plural. Yes.
The royal plural.
Yes.
It
does, and some people have suggested that. That was something else we could have mentioned. And the main problem with that, though, is that it works in English.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
But we don't have any examples in Hebrew. It seems, actually, though, you know that most of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. There's a small part written in Aramaic, parts of Daniel and Ezra. And it seems there may be a verse in Ezra written in Aramaic which might use the royal plural, but not Hebrew, it seems. So it was a good try, but I think... It works in English, but I don't think it works in Hebrew. Yeah.
But if that was the case, why should he rest on the seventh day? Why should he use that
word rest? Yes. Well, the word rest can have a variety of nuances. You know, you can rest in the sense of, I felt like sometimes when I come home from a committee, you know, oh, dear me, you know, 5 hours arguing over 2 semicolons in some paragraph, and you feel absolutely exhausted. So you feel exhausted and then rest. But rest can also mean simply cease rather than rest because you're tired. So I'm just trying to think of an example. In legal terminology, I think sometimes people talk about the case rests, okay? It doesn't mean to say that everybody's exhausted, it just means it stopped, it ceased. So the verb to rest, Shabbat, which we get the word Sabbath from, in its basic form means to cease and to stop. By extension, it means to rest, but it doesn't necessitate that somebody is, oh dear me, you know. I know that we often feel that way when we come Friday evening, you've had a hard night, a hard week, and you welcome Sabbath in that sense. But I don't think that applies to God. I think it's just in the idea of ceasing. But it has the overtones of rest. But God doesn't need to rest because he's exhausted, because as you point out, if everything is effortless, he hasn't been in a struggle with Tiamat, you know, battling it out. Everything's been effortless. Therefore, rest must have a different connotation, I think, in this context. Yeah, Rob? Yeah.
Thing, I was reading it this week, and reading the creation, it says, and he created the things that move along the ground, the wild animals and the livestock.
Yes.
And I wonder why livestock and wild animals, was there any hint here that the livestock might become helpful to man?
Yes, it probably does, I think. It probably, anticipating the creation of human beings. Well, of course, on the sixth day, God says, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and have dominion over the creation." Just as God has shown His dominion over creation, He's handing that responsibility over to human beings. So, the word that's used there about livestock, it's a general term which talks about, you know, four-legged domestic creatures in general. So what we would call, you know, cattle, sheep, goats, that sort of thing. But it might well, I think, probably does. Remember, it's written for people, you know, on the other side of the creation account. So when they hear it, they understand that it's talking to their, what they're doing. But I think you're right. Yeah, I think it does anticipate that. Yeah.
It occurs to me that after God had created, when you finish your work of art, So what you do, you step back and you look at it and appreciate it.
Yes.
Maybe that's what it meant by fresh fruit.
Yes, you know what's repeated throughout the account? It was good, 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 and it was very good. You get the sense of God at the end, as it were, having kind of a smile on his face, as it were. It's a kind of a very good, an appreciation. I mean, it is good, although it's the narrator telling us, it seems to be that this is God saw that it was good. It's his appreciation of what has happened. It's sort of just right.
But it doesn't say the Sabbath was good. That was the one.
No, that's right. I've got an answer to that, but it's going to take me a couple of minutes. So can I take some other questions? If we have time, then I'll come back to that. Yes, Doug?
Is there any aspect of refresh in the word Sabbath? Because I have been refreshed in the last hour and a half just by listening.
Right. Well, if you look up the word Sabbath in a dictionary, it won't give refresh as a meaning. But I think for those of us who experience Sabbath, then there is a refreshing aspect to it. But it isn't something which is the meaning of the word as such. But those who embrace it experience it. Yeah. Yes?
A couple of questions, if I may. Firstly, picking up on your final point about Sabbath as a work of creation of holy time, could you comment, please, on chapter 2, verse 2b? And I'll read, this is the NRSV. On the seventh day, God finished the work he had done.
Yeah.
Presumably, on your hypothesis, that including the holy time, and he rested on the seventh. I mean, it seems to me there is a slight contradiction there against what you proposed.
Okay, so the first part of the verse, sometimes I need to say, what I sometimes say to people is, you remember, I didn't write this, I'm just trying to understand it, you know. But the first part of the verse says, on the seventh day God finished the work that he'd done. So it seems clear that on the seventh day God finished the work that he'd done. And then the other one, he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So I would say that he does those two things. He both, he doesn't create anything physical, but verse 3 explains what he did, I think. He blessed the seventh day, he hallowed it, he made it holy, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation.
Could this perhaps imply that the resting of God on the Sabbath day, the creation of holy time, is actually a work which needs to be transmitted to the readers at that time and perhaps to us today, given that for a very large proportion of Adventists, Sabbath is actually the busiest day of the week in terms of physicality.
Yeah. So your point is that that there is a work done on the seventh day, and that is that what you're saying, and that's the creation of the Sabbath. Is that what you're saying? Or
well, I thought that was what I understand.
That's right. Yes, I think that's what I would say. Yes. The point about the Sabbath being, you know, a busy day, I really think that if we're serious about the Sabbath, I think we need to take a hard look at that, because my late mother-in-law, my wife's here, her mum, when my wife was younger, her father had four churches. And you know, nobody in any of those four churches could do any of the preaching or anything. So you travel around four churches on the Sabbath, you know, Sabbath school, you know, doing a circuit of about 100 miles, And at the end of the day, my mother-in-law used to say, "Oh, I think I've got my Sabbath headache." It's a sad comment when you feel your Sabbath headache coming on, because I think it denies. There's nothing wrong with fallow time. It's creative time. Well, anyway, I'm digressing, but I mean, I think I'm agreeing with what you're saying. Yeah, you had a second question.
Yes, now this might be just more difficult, I'm not sure. A number of times in your presentation, you use the phrase or something like it, the people of the time.
Right, yeah.
Now, could you elaborate on that, please?
Okay, when I talk about the people of the time, we're looking at the cultures surrounding Israel. So you have basically Mesopotamian culture and Egyptian culture. Now, most of the work that has been done on looking at the relationship between Genesis and other creation accounts has tended to concentrate on Mesopotamian sources. And that's really based on theories concerning when Genesis was written and what have you. But more recently, more people have been looking at the points of contact with Egyptian culture. Now, Egyptian culture is more complex because it's spread over a longer period of time, and Egyptian religion is just simply more complex. But when we talk about the people of the time, what we're really limited to is literature we have from the cultures of the time, and essentially that comes down to Mesopotamia, Babylon, Assyria, and Egypt. So by the people of the time, those are the dominant cultures that we're talking about, because they're the people who've left us literature on the matter. Okay. Yes.
So to go back to let us.
Yeah.
Nothing was made that wasn't made for him or by him. Surely, this is a Godhead, this is a Trinity that are saying, let us make man in our image.
Yes. Well, I was agreeing with you until you said surely. Because, yes, you may feel that I'm splitting hairs here, but if you ask me, do I believe that the Trinity was involved in the creative act? My answer is yes. But the use of the plural in one verse, was the Trinity not involved any other time?
We are not just, this is good, yes. Good man.
Yes. Good. Yes. Well, everything that God had made was very good. What I would say to you, though, is that the plural is simply plural. It just means more than one. It could be 2, 3, 11, 139. In and of itself, it doesn't necessarily mean three. Now, of course, retrospectively, looking back on this Old Testament text from the perspective of the New Testament, Is the Trinity present in the creative act? Yeah, of course. So that's not the issue. It's arguing on the basis of the let us. Now you may think I'm just being a pedantic old so and so, but that was a nod of your head, was it? I just think it's a little bit. I wouldn't want to put my head on the block on that. Do I believe in the Trinity? Yes. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit present in the creative act? Yes. But we see that, I think, retrospectively once we have a New Testament revelation. I just personally think it's a bit early to go looking for the Trinity in Genesis 1. That becomes clear at a later time, I think. Anyway. Yes, Doug.
Your emphasis that the supreme act on the creation.
Yeah.
Does that then give us the purpose of creation? Was that God wanted to spend time with the creatures that he had just created?
But yeah, it's...
of creation is association.
The account is sort of... the account is deliberately open, I think, on that, because one of the greatest gifts that we can give any, you know, if you think about what's the greatest gift that you can give somebody, often that greatest gift is time. And making holy time creates opportunities for all kinds of things, for the welfare and nurture of creation. So it's kind of a reflection on it, you know, rather than saying the text says this. But in reflecting on it, yeah, I think that appeals to my heart. Yes.
Just a very small comment. You know, I too was under the impression that God said it's very good after creating man. But when you actually look at the text, verse 31, it says, "And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good, and there was evening."
Yeah.
So that's the end. Process.
Yeah.
He's looking back over it all and he says the whole thing is very good.
Yeah.
It doesn't specifically say just Adam and Eve.
No, it's the whole of his creative act. Yeah. Which rather suggests that the creation is now at an end, you see. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished and deemed to be very good.
And individually they were good, but put them all together it's very good.
Yes, yes. And, well, if I get the chance to answer Pastor Rod's question, I'll probably add to the comment I want to make in connection with that as well, yes.
There's actually a very interesting note and a commentary on that in my Bible, and it says about chapter 2, verse 2,
mm-hmm.
It says about being finished and rested. It said, God rested the seventh day, not because he was weary, but because nothing formless or empty remained.
Mm-hmm.
His creative work was completed and it was totally effective,
mm-hmm.
absolutely perfect,
mm-hmm.
very good. It did not have to be repeated, repaired, or revised, and the Creator rested to commemorate it.
Mm. Yeah, I think that sums it up.
That was
yes.
Really good. That
yes.
really sums up what you're trying to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, I think so. We often find out, you know, that something that confirms your prejudices is always a marvellous insight, you know, but I think that's a good point, yes. Yes?
Just another point on rest, when you think of music and you have a rest, which is a pause,
yes.
it's really to enhance the next bit, to
right,
make
yes.
it really special.
Yes.
And I think that's perhaps something we could consider.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analogy, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, music is more than just the notes. It's
you're not resting because you're tired of playing.
No.
You're having the rest in order the climax, perhaps before the climax, to make it very
and
special.
For the other, to make
yes.
an impact.
And to make an impact.
Yes, yes. No, that's a good point. Thank you. Yes. You see, in talking about creation, what it means, often we can only really deal in analogies like that. You know, it's like this, it's like that, because none of us was there to actually witness that event. No. Yes.
One final very quick question. Why do you think, I mean, we assume Moses, who wrote it anyway, and who is it for?
Well, it's for...
God's people?
Yeah, it's... I was saying that if an ancient Mesopotamian or an ancient Egyptian heard it or read it, but I don't think that was the primary readership of this. It's God's people. And it's saying you live in a world which doesn't share your convictions about the God who created the heavens and the earth. And
it was putting them straight, really.
Yes. You see, we live in a world in which many people have an entirely secular perspective on the world and creation. So the people of Genesis time are in a similar situation. They live in a world which argues differently, who has a different set of circumstances, a different set of beliefs about creation and the universe, and thus different ethics and morality. So in a way, Genesis speaks to us as well. The idea that Genesis was just reflecting the thoughts of its time just won't stand up, I don't think. It wasn't reflecting the thoughts of its time. It was actually challenging the thoughts of its time. It was radical then. It's radical now. Yeah. There's just one question. You were talking about Sabbath. It doesn't say that. I'm going to finish on this, okay? When you mentioned that it doesn't mention on the seventh day that the Sabbath was good. Now, briefly, when you start reading Genesis 1, after a while you get on a roll because it's very repetitive. And each day of creation, every day of creation has got five elements. Some days have more than that, but they all share these five elements. And they all begin with an announcement, and God said, a command, let it be or let there be, a report that it happened and it was so, an evaluation, God saw that it was good, and a time framework. There was evening and there was morning, a first day. And so you're on a roll as you go through, and God said, let there be, and it was so. God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, and God said, let there be, and it was so. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and you work all your way through. Now, there's actually only one day which doesn't have an evaluation. God saw that it was good in those first 6 days, and that is the second day. Doesn't have an evaluation. God saw that it was good. Now the second day of the week is Monday. You see, so even for God, Monday isn't a good day, you see. But the effect of that is that you get that evaluation. You know those, if you can stay with me, you've got those like one days, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You get an evaluation on day one, day two, day one, not on day two, but two on day three. And then you get one on day four, one on day five, and two on day six. So when it says that God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, it is the seventh evaluation. Seven means completeness, wholeness, perfection. So the seventh occurrence is the superlative. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now, when you come to the seventh day, there is no, you've mentioned the fact that there's no evaluation. That's true. But when you come to it, there is no announcement. It doesn't say, and God said. There's no command. God doesn't say, let there be. There's no report, because there's nothing to report, as it were, because there's no command. There's no evaluation. God saw that it was good. And there's no time framework. There was evening and there was morning, a seventh day. It's not there. In other words, every single element that is repeated relentlessly throughout the entire account, days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, every one of those elements repeated and repeated and repeated, every one of them is missing on the seventh day. Because the seventh day is a holy day, holy time, and the basic meaning of holy, basic meaning of the word holy is set apart. And Genesis sets it apart for us. It doesn't have any of the elements of any of the other days, because it's a totally and utterly different day. So that's why there's not an evaluation.